You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia, brought to you by iWoke Up, flexible loans built for small businesses.
Cozze citene, cozze, cozze piscine, non spigudeci cora, non spigudeci cora. Cozze citene, cozze, cozze piscine, non spigudeci cora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Where are we today, Lionel?
We're in Barolo, Richard. Prestigious wine country, appropriately for our wine stage of our Giro.
The best stage, isn't it? Never mind the Queen stage and the, you know, all that nonsense. The wine stage is the day we all wait for, isn't it? We all look forward to, isn't it? Richard's grimacing.
I've only made one, because it's tended to fall on a day when I haven't been at the Giro, so I was
no
only there for one.
No coincidence.
I think, was it 2016, Lionel?
Well, let's see how Daniel's memory of the recent wine stage is. Can you match the stage winner to the wine? 2016?
Oh, the years are harder than that. I'm going to give you the wine stages, as I recall them. 2013, Barolo. And I think that was won by Uran. I'm not looking this up, by the way. 2014, was it a Prosecco time trial won by Kirienka? 2016, was that a time... 2015, I'm not too sure on at the moment. 2016, a time trial in Chianti won by Roglic. 2017... Oh, 2017, not sure. There was a Franciacorta stage, which wasn't a time trial. Not sure who won that.
Oh, I'm enjoying this.
And where else would there have been a wine stage? Where
flapping else? About like a... Something's about... been flapping about on the beach like a whale that can't get back into the sea.
Go on then.
Okay, well, you're right. 2016, Primoz Roglic won in Chianti. Richard's got a great story about that. We'll tell at a live event one day.
What is my story about Roglic? Roglic's bike not passing the test initially, and he had to ride it on a spare bike, didn't he?
Well, there was that, but then an unfortunate fate befell you that evening, didn't it, Richard? But
that's why I've been banned from the wine stage ever since.
2017, Daniel, was Tom Dumoulin won in Montefalco.
Oh,
time
yes,
trial.
Of course.
You were right about the Franciacorta sparkling wine. Elia Viviani won there. And then last year was another time trial. I mean, this was a slightly controversial wine stage, I think, wasn't it?
It was Sangiovese, wasn't it?
Yeah, but the time trial finished in San Marino. But yeah, there's something, some crossover here in recent years between time trialing and wine trialing.
And Roglic won that as well, didn't he?
He did.
The time trial, yeah. Yeah.
Obviously enjoys a nice drop of wine.
Enjoys the wine stage, yeah. Well, what's coming up in today's episode, Daniel?
Well, Rich, we hinted yesterday, we said yesterday that we were going to be speaking to Brian Nygaard, former press officer of many teams, CSC, Sky, Orica, Green Edge, or what later became Mitchelton. Mitchelton as well, of course, a wine company. And he then was he was also the manager or the team principal or the head honcho at Leopard Trek, I think we were supposed to refer to it as, when they launched. And is now making wine in California, which is a bit of a turn up for the books. And yeah, we're going to be speaking to Brian about his life in cycling and wine. Which, you know, very appropriate as this is the wine stage and we're going to Barolo. We're also napalm heading to, well, we're heading through Barbaresco where we had a lovely night last year and we were supposed to stay there again in the 2020 Giro because there was a stage starting in Alba, white truffle capital of Italy, the world, and Barbaresco is not far from there. We were going to be staying at the Ristorante Rabaia. Hopefully we'll be back there, who knows, in October.
The hog of Watford would have been in his element on today's stage. Can you give us a tale of the tackle, please?
Snuffling away, yeah. Yeah, just knocking all the truffles off onto the table and then scampering after them. Yeah, just a couple of things. The pronunciation police will be having a field day here. Brian Nygaard, as we always call him, but in his home Danish, it's Nygaard, but he's given Brian us dispensation. Something
along the lines of Brian Nygaard.
Also, just on pronunciation, the Leopard Trek team, when they were founded, they sent out quite a snooty press release. I don't know whether this was Brian's doing or whether he'd moved up the chain by then. I'm sure he'll be in touch to set me straight if I'm wrong here. But they insisted that the team be pronounced Leopard, which I thought was odd.
That'd be handy, I think. That'd be a useful precedent for other teams to copy, or even maybe riders sending out their own press releases telling people how to... Oh, press releases landed from Michael Morkov.
They got a lot of praise.
He says it's okay to call him Michael Morkov.
they got a lot of praise for that, a very stylish team kit, didn't they? And they got less flattering remarks for the directive that seemed to have gone out to all the riders that they had to wear some kind of silk scarf. Remember those silk scarves with de rigueur at the team presentation?
The pronunciation police would
very dapper.
There'd be redundancies galore at the pronunciation police, wouldn't there? It'd be the whole department would just be cleaned out if the riders and the teams all sent out their own press releases.
Took it on themselves, yeah.
Anyway, the stage goes from Magenta to Barolo, 185.2 kilometres, and it gets lumpy towards the end. And our stage on the RGT cycling platform is quite lumpy, goes over three medium-sized-ish climbs. It's quite long as well, 47.8 kilometres, so we could be in the saddle a while, Richard. Let's hear how it's going out on the course.
Marovegni, I think your job is safe. Daniele Fribarincini stepping into the race director's shoes for our Giro. Well, he's designed an absolute killer, and there's a mutiny among the riders. I'm not sure I'm going to finish today's 18th stage, the so-called wine stage. But I'm not sure I'm going to enjoy my wine after this one. Certainly going to take me a while to recover. And while I'm here, a reminder that on Sunday at 10 a.m, much easier 16 kilometre leg stretcher into Milan. Join Lionel and me at 10 a.m. on the RGT platform. That's 10 a.m. British summertime. Very sociable ride, usually on a Sunday morning. And also while I'm here, I've got a big pile of books here in envelopes waiting to be posted out. Trying not to drip any sweat on them, but if any of you would like to read our book, The Grand Tour Diaries, you can get 20% off it if you sign up as a friend of the podcast, or you get a signed copy if you sign up as a very good friend of the podcast. It's also available through our website, thecyclingpodcast.com. If you're missing the Grand Tours, you can enjoy our diaries from the last 2 years, 2018 and 2019. Sorry about the noise in the background, that's not my knees. That's kind of like some kind of electric drilling machine, which might as well be working on my knees, to be perfectly honest. Until tomorrow.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia. Brought to you by iWaka. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
My name's Lawrence, and I look after the go-to-market strategy for a new iWaka product called iWaka Pay. So iWaka Pay lets small businesses get paid up front for their invoices while their customers spread their costs over 90 days. It's a very new product. It's been in the market, testing in the market since February. We are kind of just doing whatever we can to get the word out there about the product during these times. I mean, with what's been going on recently, I guess lots of businesses are very understandably worried about their cash flow and about paying or receiving invoices. And I think it's understandable that businesses are struggling to pay and collect on invoices outstanding. So we're just trying to help as many people as we can.
Thank you very much indeed to our lovely headline sponsor, iWaka, without whose support we wouldn't have been able to
undertake this challenge of completing a Giro d'Italia that's been an entire figment of our imaginations, really.
Exactly. Well, their support really allowed us to plan it and execute it. We're almost at the end of our Giro now. So, well, we'd like to say a huge thank you to Iwoka, who, as we said last week, have been accredited by the British Business Bank to offer CBILS. That's big news for them and big news for some of the businesses they support. It's the Coronavirus Business Interruption Loan Scheme. You can register your interest at iwoka.co.uk. And on the website, there's a lot of information for anybody curious about support or loans that are available if you run a small business. Lionel, I'll set you the challenge of finding something there to talk about. What did you find?
Well, you mentioned our lovely title sponsors, Iwoka, and the company that I've been reading about is called Lovely Drinks. And when any small business starts up, the people behind it, they're passionate about the thing that they're creating, in this case drinks. Maybe the business aspect of it is the kind of the ballast, isn't it, that's always there sort of holding you back. And you know, while you've got these ideas of driving the business forward and with your product, you've got to, you know, keep the actual business running. And I was watching a little video which features the founder of Lovely Drinks, Rick Freeman. Lovely Drinks is a family business. They make the sort of soft drinks that sound very appealing to me on a warm day, elderflower presse, fiery ginger beer, or a sour cherry cola among them. And they've gone from a real sort of humble beginnings, and they've been shortlisted for BBC Food and Farming Awards. Both his son and daughter work for the company, and they took out some finance with Iwoka basically to undertake that word again, a rebrand. And well, this, we've been in this position before, haven't we, Rich? You know, you want your visual identity to be attractive, but it's one of those jobs that you kind of put off because it costs money, and you kind of think, well, is this a smart way of spending money now? Will the benefit be immediately obvious? And so it's one of those things that a lot of companies, I suspect, put off. And so taking out some finance to spread the cost of a rebrand, in this case Lovely Drinks wanted to revamp the look of their products in order to be more appealing to the customers. You know, spreading that cost out over a longer period of time with some finance really makes sense. And what interested me about the video was that they found Iwoka through Google and just went from there, applied for a loan, and they were offered finance within 24 hours. And there we go. The sort of the short-term risk of a rebrand is taken out of the equation by getting some finance sorted.
Yeah, well, we all want our visual identity to be attractive, don't we? Are you talking about the podcast, though, here, rather than...
I'm talking about the podcast rather than the podcasters. I think I'm beyond a rebrand.
We're beyond that. Yeah, yeah. Too late. Not even Iwoka can help us there.
Vino del giorno. Chin chin.
So as the cycling podcast wheels its way into Piedmont, we've got two wines. First up, the Carema Classico, which is in the Algiro 12-bottle case that is from the terrace vineyards at the foot of the Alps. This particular wine is made by a social cooperative who barrel-age the Nebbiolo for 12 months and then leave it in bottle for a further 12 months. The net result of this is a lovely aroma of red cherries, roses and leathery tar that on the palate shows a medium body, some lively acidity, but some refined tannins, flavour of dark cherry, some leather that really is fantastic with things like pheasant, cured meats, grilled meats and some harder cheeses. So the baby Giro includes the Uli, Barbera and Berta, which is an organic wine where the Barbera vines are grown in limestone soils on the hills in Piedmont. The fruit is then crushed and fermented in stainless steel for 12 months that really show a purity and honesty of black fruits tinged with violet, blackberry, raspberry and wild strawberry flavours that make this medium body wine tinged with a little bit of spice really perfect for some midweek drinking. Really versatile drinking as well, in terms of you can have it as a glass on its own or pair it with a pizza or a pasta or something simple. Anyway, we hope you enjoy both of the wines and look forward to speaking to you soon.
Well, cheers, chaps.
Cheers. A very, very, this is going to shock you, very controversial, contrary choice from me for wine of the day today. We're going to Barolo, and I've chosen a Nebbiolo, or Greg and I from Divine Cellars, we chose a Nebbiolo that was not from Barolo or anywhere near Barolo. It's like going to Naples and ordering a Papa John's pizza. This Nebbiolo is from way up We're still in Piedmont, but near Ivrea, a place called Carema, a little village where there are only two producers of Nebbiolo or of any kind of wine. Very, very inaccessible vineyards. There's an unusual method of growing the vines there on these sort of stone columns, these stone sort of pergolas and pergolas. Is that pronunciation, please? Pergolas.
Happy with that.
And happy with that. Yeah, slightly different from a Barolo. This is a bit lighter, but you look at Nebbiolo and it's always shocks you how light it is. It's a very sort of garnet ruby colour.
It's quite pink.
Yeah, very pink. And
Daniel, am I not right in thinking that Nebbiolo grapes are very dark?
Yes, they are dark.
I thought they were very dark.
They take their name from Nebbia, which is fog. There's a lot of fog in that area of Piedmont. Very beautiful area of Piedmont. I can recommend it for a holiday. Anyone who wants to go to the Lange Hills, very beautiful.
These rules are almost Orwellian, Animal Farm. All rules are absolutely important and inflexible, except when they're not, and you can just, you know, meander off.
I'm going to shoehorn in a cycling link with this wine, because this Carema wine, quite rare, not very well known. It did sort of raise its profile. I'm not sure when this was, or become quite well known in well-heeled Italian circles, because the directors and the top brass at the Olivetti company, Olivetti famous for making typewriters and electronics, they apparently used to gift their clients and their, you know, their best contact bottles of Carema. The link is Gianni Mura, who we're going to be speaking about tomorrow in our podcast about the sort of literary side of the Giro d'Italia. He always used to use an Olivetti typewriter, didn't he? There you go. What an exercise in trivial gymnastics that was.
Well, Daniel, I'm enjoying my peppery glass of wine here.
Yeah, very lively acidity peppery. In that, isn't it, Rich?
As we enjoy our wine responsibly, shall we go to your conversation with Brian Nygaard, who was a stand-in at the Giro last year when you were left on your own, when Lionel came back to the UK for a football match. Brian Nygaard was a more than able stand-in. And I'm surprised Lionel got his place back, to be honest. But anyway, he did. But you caught up with him in California. Here he is.
Brian, I don't know if you realise, but this time last year, you and I, it was a momentous occasion because you and I were single-handedly keeping the cycling podcast alive because Lionel had ditched me and we were in, where were we? Abruzzo somewhere?
Yeah, we were.
Or Le Marche?
Yeah, we were.
One or the other, I can't remember.
I think it was Le Marche, actually. Yeah,
Le Marche,
on the East Coast.
We did a famous podcast that will go down in history. What I don't think we spoke about that day was how the hell you got into cycling?
Honestly, that's how I would get into most other things, by luck, really. I was an academic and I thought I was going to be a career academic, if there even is such a thing. But then I was writing a little bit for a Danish magazine, and Bjarne Riis's then press officer, media director, asked me to help out at the tour with translations and things like that.
This is post-university?
Yeah. I finished my MA and I was sort of getting ready to do a PhD.
MA in what?
Philosophy, semantics, logic, stuff like that.
Natural career path to become Bjarne Riis's press officer. Yeah, but anyway, go
straight
on.
Straight line, yeah, right there. Yeah, so, and then I did the tour with them, and then what I didn't know, shortly after that, the guy who was the media director quit, and then I got a phone call, and I swear to God, I thought it was a prank call, but it was because Bjarne doesn't actually say much when he calls
people. It's like speaking to Darth Vader, I always think, when you call him up. It's one of the most intimidating things you can do in cycling, call him up.
Yeah.
You just hear the heavy breathing, yeah.
Had I known it was him, I was probably not, I wouldn't have joked about it, because I seriously thought it was a prank call. Someone calls, you know, you up, and I was 25, I had zero experience, and asked if I wanted to be the press officer for one of the biggest teams in the world. And there weren't many press officers at the time, and the ones that I knew of usually had a lot of media experience, of which I had zero. But then I realized it was actually Bjarne, and I said yes. And I wasn't really in a position to set any conditions for me working, other than I asked if I could live in Italy. I had recently been there visiting a friend who did Erasmus. And then I really fell in love with the country. And, you know, I did my first trip there to see the World Championships in 99. It was a real dream of mine to live there. And that was the only condition I set for the job. And he said, yeah, whatever, I don't really care where you live. So I next thing, I moved there and didn't really look back for a lot of, you know, for many years, basically working in
the sport. So what year was that, Brian? What was your first year at CSC?
2001.
Because I think I first saw you, I think it was in a press room at La Guelia in 2004. I think it was a couple of days after Pantani had died. But I think by that time, you'd already, your first couple of years, you'd done a lot of that kind of race, hadn't you? The small Italian races, many of which are, you know, don't exist anymore.
I did every single race, to be honest. Those first years, I don't think there was a race I didn't really go to, from everything from the Tour of the Med to La Guelia, which I actually, you know, really love. It's a fantastic race. I also made a point of going to every single bike race, and I loved the Italian ones, you know, also the later one-day races, Giro d'Emilia, Giro del Piemonte, all those.
And you were living in Lucca?
I started out living in Lucca, and then I moved to Pisa, and I lived there for a long period, and then I moved out in the hills outside Lucca, and the last place I lived for, which was probably 4 years, where I still have a home, is in Pietrasanta, which is close to the coast.
And so you started in 2002, first Giro?
No, I started in 2001, but late in the year. So the first Giro was the infamous Giro of 2002, where, yeah, the list you were listing the other night at the show, with all the catastrophes, or what you call it. That was my first Giro, the one in 2002. Did it from
with Tyler Hamilton. Michael Rasmussen was in the team. Is that correct?
Yeah. It was a hard lineup that Giro. And I had really, you know, I'd been to certain parts of Italy, but I hadn't really traveled at all extensively. So, you know, and that Giro went, you know, also deep south. So that was an interesting journey.
It's always a bit of a shock, isn't it? Because I'm a bit like you. I'd spent quite a lot of time in Italy over a number of years, but never really been south of Rome. And then when you do go south of Rome for the first time, it's a little bit of a shock, isn't it? Although, you know, I guess you, like I, at that point, had heard a lot about the differences, but, you know, you're still not quite prepared for them.
No, and when you go there, you see it in every detail. You know, it's not just, you know, from the road surface to how, you know, buildings are left unfinished. It's everything also, you know, the food, the language. You know, at that point when I did the first year in 2002, I didn't really speak much Italian. That came, you know, probably a year later, but I realized that it sounded very differently from place to place. And even now, you know, I would say I'm probably close to fluent in Italian. There's certain parts of the southern dialects where I would probably need subtitles as well.
Have you ever fallen in love with anywhere in the south? Because I, to be honest, haven't really. I mean, I suppose it depends where you draw the line of what's south and what's north. But, you know, feel very comfortable in places like Abruzzo, and there are places in Puglia which are really beautiful. But I've never really caught the bug. Caught the bug. That's probably an unfortunate figure of speech at the moment. But you know what I mean.
I mean, there's a difference between, you know, being fascinated and drawn to a place and then thinking specifically that you could actually live there. You know, that's, I really like the south, and I like, you know, definitely like the people there as well. I have a lot of people, you know, a lot of friends from the south who live in Tuscany as well. So a lot of my friends are southerners. To live there, I think, would be quite difficult. I actually, unlike most of you guys, I like Sicily. I had great times there.
Where, Brian? Where in Sicily? Because I just think I've not been to the right parts.
Well, actually, speaking of La Guelia, one year I was supposed to do the Gran Fondo La Guelia, and it got cancelled because of a landslide. And I, are they coming to get you now, Daniel? No, so I actually,
it's like being back at the 2002 Giro.
It is actually, yeah. So I jumped on a plane to Catania, and I spent a week on Etna, and it was only in probably 800 meters in La Guelia, and I found this amazing little town, and I spent sort of the most of a week riding around the volcano up and down, and you know, the food there, everything just tastes amazing. And I remember one time I was going from Lingua Glossa, where I was staying, to Bronte, which was on the other side. And I remember ordering, you know, Bronte is very famous for its pistacchio in all of Italy, really. And I was ordering a couple of cakes, a double espresso, and a bottle of water. And I think it ended up being €2.50. And I said, no, you must have dialed it wrong in on the register. And they were laughing. I said, no, why do you think that? How much is a coffee where you're from? And I said, you know, well, in Denmark, it's actually €5. And they were all laughing, and, you know, they had told it to the other customers, and they said, like, would you believe it? I said, yeah. But a barista actually makes €3,000 a month. And then they all wanted my phone number to see if they could get a job in Copenhagen. So I mean, I was like, I would say I like visiting it. I mean, I'm sure there's places also that I still have to see that I would love, places in Basilicata. I would love to spend a week with my family at Francis Ford Coppola. He has a family hotel, a boutique hotel in the middle of nowhere in Basilicata.
I didn't know that.
Villa Margherita, it's called, and I would definitely love to go and see that. So, yeah, I mean, my fascination with the South is probably also limited to me wanting to go and spend a period of, you know, of time there, but definitely not living there. That I think will always be Tuscany for me.
If we think about the Giro and talk about your Giri, I think, you know, we all, or a lot of the guys who covered races regularly knew you, but you know, you get a lot of journalists in cycling who only do the big races, only sort of parachuting for the Tour de France, and you became very well known to them in the summer of 2006 when Operación Puerto kicked off at the Tour de France for and you know, obviously CSC had riders involved in that, or had a rider, Ivan Basso, but it really broke. The whole scandal and the story broke at the Giro a few weeks earlier, and we were up at Monte Bondone in Trentino, and Ivan Basso absolutely dominated the stage there that day. And I remember the press conference afterwards. Well, in the meantime, in the sort of hour or so between him winning and him sitting down for his press conference, we'd heard that Manolo Saiz had been arrested, and this was the start of everything. What do you remember of that day?
I'm not actually sure if it was the same day, but it all accelerated extremely fast. From, you know, usually in cycling you would have a period where rumors would flourish quite lively, and you sort of, you get the wind of what's what's right and what's wrong and where a story is going. But I actually think it might have been the night before or that night after that stage. I was sitting at dinner in a hotel somewhere in the mountains, and then my phone rang. It was a Spanish number, and I always made a point of, I always answer my phone. That's kind of part of being a press officer. And then I found myself in a live radio show on Cadena SER, which was basically this, from what I remember, the radio channel that broke the story.
Yeah, it was breaking all the stories to do with Operación Puerto.
Yeah. And I was live in that show. They basically called me up and started quizzing me. And, you know, my Spanish was non-existent, to be fair. they wanted me to confirm. I remember they wanted me to confirm various things. Is this true? Is that true? And it dawned upon me that, you know, this was actually about Ivan. This was about our involvement, you know, we were under accusation. And then I, you know, first of all, you know, you really want to get the facts straight before you answer anything. And at that point, I just didn't actually specifically know what he was asking me. So I remember passing the phone to Andrea Perón, who was fluent in Spanish. And then all of a sudden, and I'm sorry for laughing right now, it was just such an absurd situation. And then all of a sudden, he was live in the Cadena SAS show trying to, like, answer to the best of his abilities. But then, it didn't take long, you know, for it to really explode right in front of us. The Giro just, we barely were able to sort of finish the Giro before it really took off. It was, those were really crazy days.
And how do you feel in a situation like that? Does it all feel a bit icky? Or are you like a defense lawyer and, you know, you're doing your job, you know what your job consists of, and that's all you're going to do? Or do you, you know, whether it's morally or just from a kind of practical point of view as well, start to feel a bit uncomfortable about the whole situation and maybe being made to lie or not being told the truth by a rider, for example?
I always try to limit, that specific interaction to being as professional as it could possibly be. I always, you know, I guess from starting when you start your first Giro, and it's the Giro of 2002, and what didn't happen at that race, I guess. So I was, you know, in the back of my mind, I was always prepared for something like that to happen. There was, you know, with very short intervals, always a scandal or two, you know, on the horizon in cycling. This just happened to be a very, very big one. So initially I tried to be as professional as I can, you know, leave my own sort of feelings aside and try and evaluate the situation to the best of my abilities, you know, do the kind of strategic communication and the advice that I think will be best long term, instead of just, you know, I wouldn't want to try and salvage the storm with a thin paper boat. You know, we want a sort of a robust way of approaching it. You know, we also had a massive American sponsor at the other end of the world trying to, like, make sense of what was going on. And I mean, I remember I was, you know, the craziest thing I probably did in that period was that I was sitting in on the hearings in Rome at Cuny with Tori, what was his name again?
Tori.
Ettore Tori. Yeah, Tori, the who was in control of that, of those hearings, and even was allowed to have, other than his lawyer, one more person there. And I actually demanded being there, and I was almost helping CSC also figuring out what was going on, because my Italian was okay at that time. I remember sitting in those hearings and answering questions, mostly I think on behalf of the team and the sponsor and how we wanted to manage the situation, and less so on behalf of Ivan, because it was, you know, he was really in a difficult situation, but most of all he also had to defend himself to the best of his ability.
Yeah, it was a sticky old business that, and of course those hearings, infamously, that was where he said that he only attempted to dope, and he did get his ban in the end and came back a couple of years later and won the Giro. But that was 2006. 2007, I think, was quite a different experience for you. You were still at CSC, another Giro in which the team was prominent for different reasons. Andy Schleck was second in that Giro, and I think you told me once that he only stayed at the race because he'd taken a shine to one of the podium girls. He was supposed to leave it a lot earlier he was supposed to only do a week or so. Is that right?
The way I remember it, he was definitely going to finish the bike race, but there weren't any pressure on him to do a result on the GC because it was still early. I mean, at that point he was probably only 21 years old. But he was obviously in the shape of his life. It's very early life at that point. And I remember that we didn't really know that it was like something that he would end up in the white jersey and let alone that early, but he was like, oh, should I hang on to this? I don't, he wasn't really sure what was going on. But he did mention to me that he was very interested in getting the phone number of one of the podium girls that he had taken a liking to. I said, well, you know, if you keep the jersey, you'll have a better chance of actually chatting to her. And then he kind of shoehorned himself into the podium by sticking, you know, to the white jersey, because everyone else mostly, you know, over the course of the race got dropped. And then he ended up doing a really solid time trial at the end, and miraculously, I wouldn't say, but very impressively finishing second as such a young rider. Another fun episode, which was not just one episode, but basically, you know, drawn out over the entire 3 weeks. At that point, Bjarne had gotten really heavily into nutrition and which is obviously very important when you work in a high performance environment and you want to get it right for the riders. But he had become quite sort of he got quite angry with the riders if they didn't do what he told them nutrition wise. And I remember him coming down to breakfast one morning at the hotel, and him and Andy and Bjarne were literally in a fight about whether Andy was allowed to eat his. He basically had like half a baguette with a couple, you know, half an inch of butter and then strawberry marmalade that he was devouring. And then it was almost like this comical scene where him and Bjarne were, you know, holding on to each end of this baguette, you know, with Bjarne not wanting him to eat it. And Andy just wanted to, that was also what I loved about Andy. You know, I'm not sure it would work in this even more, you know, specialized and science-driven era of the sport. He said, I just want my pasta with, you know, tomato that tastes so good in Italy, and in the morning, this is what I eat. And I guess, you know, for lack of a better word, the proof was in the pudding, because Andy was flying on whatever, you know, he was eating. And I think him insisting on actually eating what he wanted to and feeling good about it was part of him coping with the stress and the pressure of riding well over the course of 3 weeks. So Bjarne definitely lost that one. I didn't, you know, Andy was adamant, which is quite impressive for such a young rider to stand up against Bjarne saying, you know, I want to eat my baguette with my strawberry marmalade. and so he did.
Of course, you later went on to be Andy Schleck's team manager at Leopard Trek was the first incarnation, wasn't it? Was it called Leopard?
Yeah, it was.
But before that, Brian, last chapter before we go on to talk about your life as a journalist on the Giro last year, the 2010 Giro, you were the first press officer that Team Sky ever hired. First Grand Tour you did for Team Sky as their press officer was the 2010 Giro. There you had to deal with and manage a certain Bradley Wiggins. How was that?
Well, that was, you know, to be honest, it was a nightmare. He was very. I mean, I have, you know, don't get me wrong, I have a lot of respect for Wiggins, you know, especially in the later years, what he's accomplished. He's an absolute legend, and I think he actually, you know, he's such an asset on the commentating side of.
I thought you were going to say something else then, and you said asset. No. I thought you were going to say something.
No, I would. You know, if you asked me during the 2010 Giro, I was. And he was a real nightmare to work with, basically impossible.
How did that manifest itself?
Oh, I'll give you an example. I mean, we were, this, you know, as you said, this was our first Grand Tour and we really wanted to make our mark. And result-wise, other than him winning the prologue, it'd be hard to say that we really did have an impact on that race. I think Joni made it into top 20, but, you know, it wasn't really the rah-rah that a team like Team Sky would really enter their first Grand Tour with. And then I was talking to Angelo Somagnang and figuring out how we could sort of help him get some international recognition of the race. And I'd gotten in contact with the GQ magazine in the UK that won it, and he would happily fly them over to do a reportage based on Team Sky, which was fantastic for us. We always loved the non-endemic media writing about cycling, and that was, I guess, an important magazine. So we had it all set up. The journalist was, came to our hotel. I asked him to wait in the reception. And I didn't realize, an interview like that, I didn't want to sit in on. I didn't think it would be kind of cool for me to, you know, to sit. Not that I wasn't interested, but I just think I was pretty happy with them talking on their own. And then, you know, Wiggins leaves the table, said, yeah, he's sitting over there. His name is such and such. And yeah, you know, go and do it. And he leaves. And then an hour later, the journalist calls me and said, Yeah, Wiggins never showed up, mate. Do you think you can try and call him? And I was like, what? And then I went up to his room and he just looked at me and said, like, yeah, I just can't be asked, mate. And I was like, yeah, you can. You have to go down and talk to that guy. And he was like, nope, I can't be asked. He can just go and F himself. And I'd never, you know.
Was this after a stage or before a stage?
It was after stage. It was after stage. And it was so late in the Giro that it was definitely not that, like, we were taking anything away from Wiggins's, you know, recuperation time, because he wasn't a relevant character in the race at that point. Maybe that's why he didn't want to talk, but I was furious. That's like, you know, I was basically thinking he was an overpaid underperformer for all I knew, compared to all the, you know, amazing athletes that I had worked with, who was always happy to talk to the media and realize that was part of their job. And at that point, he certainly didn't. And I was like, well, I can't work like this. I wasn't trying to be a prima donna or drama queen, but I, you know, there was no reason for me to be at the Giro if that was kind of how we wanted to go about things. And then this is so typical Team Sky at that time. You know, everything that was dramatic and involved Wiggins that had somehow been derailed had to go through Shane Sutton. So I basically told Shane Sutton, you know, you tell your guy that, yeah,
protégé,
yeah, I guess that was the best word at that time, to go and do that interview, or, you know, I'm just out of here. I'm not spending my time here just, you know, adhering to his crazy ideas about what he wants to do and what he doesn't want to do. And then Shane had to interfere, and then eventually he got the interview done. It wasn't particularly great, but at least, you know, we had it sorted out. I remember that time I was dreading having to do the tour with him, because I was also pretty sure he wasn't going to perform up to, you know, the pretty high expectations that the team and some of the UK media had at the time, and I was dreading how that was all going to play out. And I ended up not doing that because I still eventually it turned out, I'm pretty sure she did a good job. Fran actually had to do it, you know, Fran Miller, bless her soul, a really good friend of mine, and she was, you know, by, I'm sure it wasn't voluntary, she was all of a sudden the press officer for Team Sky. And that was also typical for Team Sky, you know, at that time. You know, if everything really went up in flames, then, you know, Fran came with a fire extinguisher, as she would do so many times.
Well, having seen how fantastically journalists could be treated by riders at times, you decided that you were going to be a journalist some years later. Yeah. Last year, so 2019 Giro, in the meantime, you've been working, you've done many years at Orica, Mitchelton Scott, but you'd ceased to be a press officer, and we found you in our midst in the press room last year, and you announced that you were writing a book. I mean, how did that come about? And tell me how that was to you know, the poacher turning gamekeeper, or maybe it was the gamekeeper turning poacher, I'm not quite sure.
Well, I mean, this, you know, for, as a background, I was already working as a TV commentator for the Danish broadcast at the Tour and other races. But my passion for journalism has basically always existed, and I always enjoyed writing. And at that time, I'd already started writing for, I guess, you sort of the Danish version of The Observer called Weekendavisen, and I was doing some things for them. And then I'd done already a reportage from Lombardia, together with this Danish painter that I convinced to go and do that for me, and he would illustrate my articles. And then we agreed on doing the entire Giro, mostly self-funded, because, you know, a newspaper like that that only comes out once a week is not going to finance us traveling through Italy for 3 weeks. But I really wanted to do it, and the best way to do it then was to write a book. And I enjoyed that immensely. It was a trip of my, it's some of my best Giro memories, even just the planning part of it, because I'd always heard you lot go and complain about the hotels and the late dinner.
Not me.
But then maybe 90% of your colleagues, you know, complaining about the press buffet. It's all of a sudden, that's all, you know, the most important part of your day, because God forbid you should find your own meal. And I was like,
what do they get wrong, Brian? I mean, having seen it now and experienced it and done it right, what do the journalists get wrong?
I mean, it's not that I want to sound like Bjarne, but nutrition, mate. How can you travel around Italy and not be fairly organized around your meals? I mean, it's really hard to get a bad meal in Italy. And I know we all have work to do. And there's certainly journalists who are way more busy than I was during those 3 weeks. But I think that, you know, in the planning and just making sure that you book your hotels and with certain distances from start to finish, so you can always squeeze a nice meal in here and there. I would, you know, I don't remember over the 20 years I lived in Italy really having bad food. But I guess a lot of journalists, either for financial or other reasons, were very dependent on that press buffet. There was always so much talk about that. And so I basically set up my own route through the Giro on a budget. I think our average hotel price was 70 euros per night. But we stayed at amazing places, and the logistics worked out perfectly. And I was traveling with someone who didn't know anything about cycling. So I also wanted to take good care of him and make sure that he had the possibility to work here. But he basically had to do a piece of art every night in the course of those 3 weeks. So it was a fantastic journey, and I love it. It was during winters, probably as for you as well, when you book your hotels for the cycling podcast. I set it all up, and it was just such an enjoyable journey. I mean, also I didn't have a daily deadline, so it's easy for me to say that you all get it wrong. But just eating our way and drinking our way through Italy that way was just fantastic.
And in terms of stories and the coverage and the sort of overview you wanted to give of the Giro, I mean, what were you looking for? Because, you know, this year in our podcast, we've touched on Dino Buzzati, a classic account of the 49 Giro. But, you know, that's really interesting because, you know, Buzzati was a novelist. He wasn't a cycling writer, even if, you know, back then there were a lot of great writers who were reporting on cycling and did report on cycling in the Italian newspapers. He was even different from the majority of them, and he was quite naive and sort of willfully naive and proudly naive about bike racing. But, you know, if you read that book, it's such a unique perspective, and he barely speaks to a rider, but there's a wonder about the way he talks about the race, which I think, you know, we journalists, those of us who cover a lot of races, lose very early and don't really get back. I mean, what were you trying to do?
That's a really good point, and I think I was actually trying to do exactly that. I have to admit also, for a certain period of my working life in cycling, it probably lost its magic. For a few years, I was doing way too many races, and I was probably also had a bit of fatigue after all the issues management I had to do, and the various ups and downs of the teams that I'd worked for. So I probably got disenchanted for me as well. But I found that, excuse me, I found that back again, probably via commentating as well. And I wanted to share that fascination that I have of Italy, of the diversity of Italy, of the contrast of Italy, and also some of the great stories of the race. If you are at a point as a journalist and you obviously have to be critical, you have to weigh in on the relevance of what you write. But if you're not fascinated by cycling, it's hard to travel around for 3 weeks and also tell a story about it. So I wanted to share that fascination and share maybe sometimes different angles. I would be much just as interested in figuring out where we were in the country and sharing my joy for traveling around in that way. And I, you know, even starting out in Bologna, which is pretty close to where I live in Italy, but I haven't really spent any time there other than at the formidable Giro dell'Emilia. I loved spending time in Bologna, and I loved also going, you know, to places that I've been through, maybe in Tirreno, places like Le Marche and Abruzzo, but just seeing them in a different way and taking my time. And, you know, we ended up staying, I think, 3 nights in Ravenna, which, you know, is an incredible town if you're interested in arts and just basically sharing that with someone that is so knowledgeable about art, who was able to show me around, was just a joy. And I'll I'll always think back on that year, especially, you know, when, on a personal note, when we came to Modena, my girlfriend took the train from Pietrasanta to come and tell me that she was pregnant. And I remember just the dreamy haze of traveling around in Italy for the remainder of the race, knowing that, you know, I didn't know it was twins at the time, but just knowing that I was going to be a father. I probably also understood that this was the last time that I was ever going to be able to or even want to travel around in that manner. So it was everything was just happening in my life at a very high pace, and I leaned back into it and I was able to really enjoy it. Even for a long period of time, it wasn't the most interesting bike race in the world, was it? And it was raining for the major part of it, but I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I think, you know, fans who have not been to the Giro and you know, the high point of their cycling season as spectators is the Tour, they're often slightly mystified by, well, I think they can hear the kind of enthusiasm in our voices when we talk about the Giro and you know, we talk about how it beguiles and enchants us. But, you know, one thing that strikes me is the sort of sense of journey you get in the Giro by virtue of the fact that, you know, the country is long and thin. And you always feel as though you're either moving up or down the peninsula, basically. And you're moving from somewhere to somewhere. That sounds very obvious, but, you know, often in the Tour de France, you can feel as though you're kind of just in the middle of a big landmass and you're not really getting the sense of motion, you know, from one culture to another culture, from one region to another region. Whereas in Italy, you feel that very keenly every day. And it doesn't even take that much knowledge of Italy, I don't think, to feel that.
No, I think it's absolutely spot on. It's why, you know, that I've always loved Italy even before I knew much about it, but the Giro has just given me the possibility to see all those places that are obviously very connected and sometimes only a few hours from where I would live, but places I would have no idea of, and there would always be something interesting there, you know, and the contrast is so big and everything is so diverse. And you know, you're always in walking distance to a good meal, you're always walking distance to a nice cup of coffee. And I think the atmosphere in the country during those 3 weeks is just special, and it's something that is so far from the not always pleasant working environment that the Tour is, because there's just so many people and there's so many agendas and so many demands on the riders, and I guess also on journalists at times. And the Giro is just, it's sometimes it's slower, sometimes it's faster, but I always sort of rely on the fact, well, we're in Italy, so, you know, it's going to be okay. Sometimes, in, you know, late at night at the Tour, when you have to, you know, you arrive at the hotel at 11 o'clock and there's no food and it's, you know, it's a pretty shitty hotel, and then you can, if there's any breakfast, it'll be bad as well. Not that breakfast is great in Italy. I just don't, the joy of traveling is never present really much during the Tour, but it is always during the Giro.
I'm Matteo Sobrero, and I rode for NTT Pro Cycling. And my family has a winery, and me and my sister will be the fourth generation of my family that are making wine. I'm really proud of that, and I really hope to, in the future, to continue with my family, with my sister. We have just Nebbiolo, because we are really close to Barolo. We are really on the borderline, on the limit, but we are not in the area. So we cannot do Barolo or Barbaresco. We are just in the middle of the two area. Yeah, we make 50,000 bottles for here. And we have Dolcetto d'Alba, Barbera, and Nebbiolo, Chardonnay. This year we start to plant some Pinot Noir, or make some Spumante, some Alta Langa for in the future. I studied for to be a vignaiolo, but I always had a plan A and B in my life, when I grow. Because before was the plan A was to continue my passion in cycling, and my big dream to become a professional cyclist, and to the other side there was a plan B to stay at home with my family, and to the another big passion that was to make wine. So yeah, I grow with two plan, and always said I study for that, and I finish the school of for make wine in Italy, and now I'm leaving the plan A, but most probably, yeah, in the future, I want to continue also with the plan B. Like in cycling and in the wine, you never know what will happen during the season, like for the weather in wine, but in cycling is a lot of things. In the race, you never know what can happen. Yeah, it's a lot of stuff that is similar. I'm good in the climber, but I'm not a really climber. But I'm also fast for a small bunch sprint. So, and I'm also good in the time trial. And last year I was Italian under 23 Italian champion. To be honest, I don't understand yet what really kind of rider I'm. Like an Italian professional cyclist, my dream is a stage in the Giro, or for example a classic like Lombardia. But yeah, is a dream, and is a big dream.
Just give me a quick rundown, Brian. A few bullet points of some of the things you did write about.
I did write about Bologna a fair bit. I wrote about Abruzzo. I wrote about Pier Paolo Pasolini's travels through Italy. I wrote about the contrast between north and south. And then I spent many a page writing about a restaurant in Cecina, which is a place, you know, it's definitely not known for its beauty as a town, but there is an amazing restaurant that has a lot to do with cycling. It's run by a couple that are very close to Paolo Bettini, Piero Gemma Falorni, and it's just, for me, it's the best restaurant in the world, really. And it's definitely not because of its interior decoration, it's just because of the food and the love for cycling. So I really wanted to take my time to write an homage to that couple. And, you know, one of my daughter's middle name is named after Gemma, the owner. So it's obviously a place that's very special to me. And it's always, you know, I got to know about it during Gira, what's it called, Costa degli Etruschi, which is one of the smallest early bike races in Italy. And then my good friend Alessandro Tenier took me there. And since then, I've been coming there very regularly for the most part of my adult life. And I really wanted to write a good piece about them. So that's probably one of the things I'm more happy about in the book, is being able to show my love and appreciation for that specific restaurant, which I guess is a very typical thing for someone that's, I guess, at this point, half Italian as myself. I did also wanted to do a reflection on a more sad note on the death of Wouter Weiland. And I wanted to put it in the context of my time with that team and Leopard Trek and everything that was going on there, and all the crazy things that happened, and basically also do a reflection about cycling and life, and you know, unfortunately, the death as well. It was a hard chapter for me to write, but I really, once and for all, I felt like I had to do it.
And generally speaking, you enjoyed the experience so much that you decided to completely kick cycling into touch, and you've not only left Europe, but you've become a, well, you're not a winemaker, but you're managing a vineyard. I mean, what happened, Brian? Did you watch sideways and, you know, decide that was the life for you, or explain? Well, let's explain first your passion for wine. Where does that come from?
Basically, it started, I think, more or less around the same time I started to get into cycling in my late university years. And I think my passion for cycling and my passion for wine have always been competing about my attention for the last, yeah, for 20 years at least.
And you see, I have a kind of similar thing, and it's difficult to explain that the two sort of, they're kind of interweaved, or they have a lot in common. Yeah, they do have a lot in common. They, particularly, you know, the countries in which the two things are strongest or have historically been strongest.
I mean, basically, I was offered this job the first time just shortly after I left Leopard Trek in that very crazy period, I suppose, of my life. And I didn't really feel like I was done with cycling, so I ended up doing another 6 years almost with Orica Greenedge, Mitchelton Scott now. And then I worked for 3 years as a commentator. And then, you know, when it's hard to really make a living by commentating bike races for 67 days a year, and And I really felt it was probably the time of my life, you know, being soon to be a father of two twin girls, that I would like to have a different kind of everyday life. And seeing that this possibility for me over here in Northern California was still an option, I really went for it. It was a really hard thing to get the visa. And then the visa category I applied for was very difficult. And once again, you know, cycling really helped me. I needed a lot of support letters for things I'd done in my career. And all my friends in cycling came to the fore. You know, Dave Brailsford wrote a fantastic support letter. Wow. Shane Bannon wrote a fantastic support letter. Lars Seier of Saxo Bank wrote a fantastic support letter. And I really pulled all that together in a short amount of time. And then I got the infamous 01A visa, which is the hardest visa to get, thanks to my, you know, the support I got from the cycling community, really. And then I moved over here, and I always said that if I wasn't to live in Tuscany, I would like to live in Northern California because of the wine and because of how amazing it is to ride your bike here, for the climate also, obviously. And then yeah, here I am.
Tell us a bit about the wines and the winery.
I suppose if you only know one Californian wine, is probably Napa Valley, but Sonoma is in the same area, but it's closer to the coast, which makes it very different from a winemaking perspective, because we have very cool nights. We have fog coming in, which means that we're able to do a lot more, in my opinion, balanced wines and wines that are, you know, a bit less heavy on oak and fruit. Some of them potentially even in a more European style. And so the Russian River runs right through the ranch where I work, and it just gives us a fantastic microclimate to do different types of wine. We have benchland, we have hillside sections. We mostly produce Chardonnay and Cabernet, but we also have a little bit of Petit Syrah. We have some Sauvignon Blanc. We have, you know, various varietals that are interesting to work with. And we're just blessed with an amazing sort of corner of California coast, almost coastal climate, where we are able to, I think for me at least, produce really interesting wines.
And Brian, what are people saying in the wine producing areas of California about, well, how is the coronavirus affecting the industry at the moment, and how might it affect the industry in the next few months?
It's definitely been a difficult period to do business development in the new job at a winery. You know, obviously wholesale is looking a lot different, and, you know, seeing that restaurants are closed and going to be continuously closed for quite a while, we've lost a lot of sale that way. But people are buying a lot of wine online, and we've been, you know, fortunate to really push that part of the business. And you know, at the moment, we're actually in a better position with those types of sales than we were last year. So we've been able to salvage a lot that way. Everything is quite unpredictable, and it's not, I guess, the most comfortable time to be in America, you know, to a certain degree. But I feel, at least here in Sonoma, and also in this corner of Sonoma where I am, things are somewhat under control. The numbers here are good, and I don't really feel like I'm in the middle of a pandemic, but I feel like I'm in the middle of a shit show when I'm listening to Trump or reading the paper about what's going on elsewhere. So there's a certain kind of eeriness to what the future will bring. And then, you know, for various reasons, I'm not able to be with my family right now because there's a travel ban and they're still stuck in Europe. So everything is a little bit, it's very far from normal at the moment, I guess.
And just tell us the name of the winery, should anyone find themselves in Sonoma.
I would absolutely love to have visitors here once we open up again. And I would say anyone that comes with a cycling connection, I'll be the first to offer them a glass of wine of their choice. So it's called Stuhlmüller Vineyards. There's a lot of German ancestry in this part of California for wine growers. So we're outside a small town called Healdsburg, which is, I think, a lot of cyclists in this area are familiar with that. I can never pronounce the name right, but, you know, Axel Merckx's development team, they have their service course here in town for obvious reasons, because this is an amazing place to ride your bike.
Of course, in California, in Southern California, there's a Danish enclave, isn't there, in Solvang, a place where you've been, I'm sure, on many occasions. Yeah. And I went on two or three occasions as well with a tour of California. We were talking about it the other day in relation to Mario Cipollini, because it was where Mark Cavendish infamously overtook him in a time trial with one leg.
I remember that. I was driving the car behind Jay McCarthy at that time trial. I remember that episode. Yeah, we did some training camps down in Solvang, which is, it's like almost like Legoland, only not built by Lego. It's really a strange place, little Danish enclave, but sort of all the cliche and kitschy part of parts of Denmark. But as a wine growing region, it's very interesting.
Actually. It is. And just down the road from the Neverland Ranch, I took a bike ride once from Solvang. We rode past the front gates of Neverland.
On the way towards Los Olivos.
Yeah, Figueroa Road, the climb.
That's a very famous climb.
Yeah. And Brian, so the other day we had John Dickey, an expert on the Mafia, on the podcast, and I asked him how true to life The Godfather was. And, you know, if that's all people had seen and that's all they knew about the Mafia, you know, how well informed would they be? I'm going to ask you the same question about Sideways and Sonoma Valley and Napa Valley wine.
Oh, very similar. I think the way, you know, tasting rooms operate and the type of tourism we have here, you know, the people who are passionate about wine, they would drive around and do winery hopping. So I think it's very realistic. You know, the Sideways is set on the central coast of California. We're obviously somewhat further north, but it's very similar. Only the landscape here is somewhat different, also from a bike riding perspective. But yeah, I think we would best basically see the same type of people coming into a winery. What's it? Miles is called, isn't he? The main character. Yeah, I adore that film, and I have a lot of memories from that part of the world as well. Yeah, so if you and Lionel and Richard were
definitely
to do
not a, Richard. I can't see Richard doing a wine tour of Sonoma anytime soon.
But you would be very welcome, and should it happen again that they would do the tour of California, so it doesn't interfere calendar wise with the Giro, I would be happy to host you here.
And very last thing, Brian, and we're speaking to you today on the day when our Giro visits Barolo, and I think you're a bit of a Barolo man, aren't you? I think you I seem to remember having a Barolo
at your from the Giro actually about that.
Oh, do you?
I guess it's 10 years in the past now, so I can say it without any sort of potential lawsuit. So that was my first Giro with Sky, and there were a lot of rules. There was basically nothing but rules about what we could and what we couldn't, and it was definitely frowned upon if you stopped during the stage and had lunch, and that it was something that they did not want us to do. And I didn't really care. And I was traveling the Giro as I used to anyway. So I stopped in Novara to lunch.
Lovely risotto in Novara, probably.
Yeah, it's in the middle of nowhere, isn't it? And I found this restaurant using the La Repubblica, the Guida dell'Espresso, which I always meant that
you
I would
recommend
end up
it to me. Yeah, great tip.
Yeah. I would always end up at the same restaurants as Gianni Mura or Philippe Brunel, so I knew I was on the right path. But that day I found myself alone in this amazing little family restaurant, and we ended up talking about wine. I mean, this isn't exactly in Piemonte, but it's close enough for them to have a wine list that's focusing on those types of wines. And their cellar was incredible. They had so many beautiful and mature aged wines, you know, from the late 70s and the mid 80s, some of the really big vintages. And they were complaining that they couldn't really sell any of these wines because they've been sitting on them for so long and there wasn't really an audience for it. And I said, well, I'll take them. So I bought, the prices were amazing. So I filled up my Team Sky Jaguar with thousands of euros of incredible wine, including my two favorite producers from the region, Bruno Giacosa and Giacomo Conterno. There was a lot of very valuable wine in the car that day. And I remember going to the finish, and this was the part of the year where we were basically done having an influence on the race, and there wasn't much work for me at the finish line. So I found a cold place at the hotel where I could park my car. I mean, this was a hot Giro in May. And then during the night, in the dark of the night, I drove all the way to Tuscany, which is like at least three hours of driving just to drop that wine off in my cellar in the hills in Lucca. And then I drove the 3.5 hours back again. I didn't get any sleep because of those bottles, but those were incredible bottles. There aren't many left of them in my collection anymore from that bounty anyways. But it was just one of those stories where I had to get that wine and I had to get it safely to my cellar. That's such is my love for Piemonte wines.
Classic Nygaard. I would even say vintage Nygaard, that story. Well, Brian, I'm gonna toast you from a distance. We're having a lovely Nebbiolo, a lovely Barolo today, and I'm sure you're enjoying one of your own Cabernets or Chardonnays. So cheers. Chin chin.
Thank you. Chin chin.
The Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for supporting Cycling Podcast since the Giro d'Italia in 2016. They have been a great supporter of the podcast since then, and they're offering 25% off to you at scienceandsport.com with the code Daniel.
Science and Sport.
Yeah.
25. Get all your products here.
Note to producer, please keep that silence in. SISCP25. SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. Absolutely appalling.
It's like being attacked by your own teammates, isn't it? This every time.
An athlete, is he, Lionel? He's not using Science and Sport products like we are at the moment, burning through them to get around our Giro.
We
heard from
Strava
Brian.
Strava says otherwise. Anyway, go on.
Brian Nygaard, we heard from at length there, talking about his life in cycling and why.
Invitation to all of us chaps. You too, Rich. Visit him in Sonoma. Yeah. I could see us doing that, recreating Sideways, only, you know, with a bit of a podcast.
What's it?
Podcast twist, yeah, to it.
Why not? What's the code that people will need to go and get their 25% discount from Brian? Thanks for that, Brian. Very interesting to hear a bit about his journey. You said something interesting, or at least it was interesting to me, that you both agreed that there were lots of parallels between cycling and wine, and being somebody who really enjoys wine, but as you know, I don't have a great deal of knowledge of it, despite being a former vice president of the Aberdeen University Wine Society.
Now defunct.
A kind of honorary position, that. Now defunct.
But I think membership of that was based on consumption rather than expertise.
Oh, come on. Yes. Anyway, Daniel, what did you mean by that exactly? What would you like to elaborate?
I think there is a big link, where it's obviously a big connection. There's the whole
what do they
issue
have in
of man and nature, and how man brings his influence to bear on the natural world. Obviously appeals to me as a self-professed man of the natural world. But there's, I don't know whether it's coincidence, but a lot of the regions that have traditionally been strongest, wine growing regions, or the regions with the strongest tradition. So France, Spain, Italy in particular, they're also regions that have been strongholds in professional cycling. It's a strange, the wine industry is a strange industry. I always found it strange. I mean, I had two working experiences in the wine industry. One was a fairly menial job in the Prosecco region of Italy, and the other was a sort of apprenticeship as a winemaker in Switzerland, which didn't, was quite short-lived. But it's a world that juxtaposes sort of high society, certainly viewed from a kind of Anglo-Saxon point of view. It juxtaposes kind of high society. It's a luxury product with farmers and peasants and people who are very unpretentious. And there's a lot of snobbery, but there's also a kind of reverse snobbery. I mean, I always found it quite uncomfortable mixing in both circles, really. And I think over the last few years, particularly again from an Anglo-Saxon point of view, we've seen the sort of the socio-demographic nature of cycling, the people who are into cycling, people who are attracted to cycling, change, and it's really sort of lurched towards the sort of upper middle class end of the scale, when traditionally it was a very working class sport, certainly in a lot of places.
Well, what's interesting to me, I think, I'm not so sure about Italy, but certainly in France, is that knowledge of wine doesn't have the same associations as it has here. So if you're knowledgeable about wine here in the UK, it is associated with being a member of the elite, I suppose. It's quite a snobbish thing to know about, whereas it doesn't have that same class association at all in France. And, everybody in France kind of grows up with that knowledge of wine. I'm trying to think of an equivalent here, and I'm not sure what it would be, but the associations here seem to me to be very different to France, at least. I'm not sure if it's the same in Italy.
Yeah, I think another thing that they have in common is how multi-dimensional they both are. And, wine is a subject that anyone who professes to be an expert on wine will always inevitably still have huge gaps and huge holes in their knowledge, because, from grape varieties to different sort of regulations in different regions and countries, it is simply impossible to know everything. And cycling is kind of, you know, is similar. There are over 1,000 professional cyclists, or at last count probably are, countless teams as well, and races that go on, you know, every day of the year, all across the world. And you know, it's impossible to know everything. But, you know, if you are a curious person and you're curious about different parts of the world and different cultures, you can really dive pretty deep into cycling in the same way that you can dive very deep into wine. And I think that's one thing that perhaps attracts the same type of person to both.
Yeah, I think both are accessible, aren't they? But then there's sort of an almost infinite depth to the knowledge that you can accrue, or the extent to which you want to get interested and indulge that interest. I mean, everyone likes a nice glass of wine. I mean, well, not everyone, but, you know, lots of people like a nice glass of wine. And when people discover cycling, it's this sort of, you know, incredible, vibrant, colourful world with these great landscapes and the kind of the customs that you learn about, you know, the rules about not attacking the race leader when they have a mechanical problem and so forth. And just when you think you've kind of cracked that and understood what the unwritten rules are, something will happen that then unlocks a whole other chamber of knowledge that you can then sort of step into. And and then of course there's a whole historical aspect. Now I suppose wine is similar. You can think, well, I quite like these wines, and then suddenly you discover another region or another another grape variety. If you've exhausted the reds, you can move on to the whites.
There you go, Napalm. But there are also, and there have also been a number of people over the years, rich families, who have had a foot in both the wine industry and in cycling. We heard from Matteo Sobrero earlier, who has a sort of fledgling career with NTT, a very promising Italian rider, climber, whose family is from, well, lives right in the heart of the sort of best, the most prestigious Piedmontese wine country between Barolo and Barbaresco. But there have been other families, great sort of cycling dynasties that have also been great wine dynasties. The Moser family, we mentioned Francesco Moser, we've talked about him quite a lot over the last week, still a winemaker from a winemaking family. His son Ignazio was a promising young rider, rode for BMC, the BMC development team, quit cycling a few years ago, is now a winemaker, but more famously, probably in Italy, has become a bit of a, well, he's become a celebrity on sort of Big Brother type programs. Well, Big Brother was the one that, Grande Fratello was the one that really sort of propelled him into the limelight in Italy. Infamously on that show, live on Italian national television, he bragged about the number of women he'd enjoyed the company of. I think it was 170. And worse than that, that he kept a diary with grades for their performances. And yeah, that didn't go down too well. Even in Italy, that didn't go down too well.
You can see why his lifestyle may have been incompatible with that of a professional cyclist, perhaps. He was a fixie. I mean, he was riding fixed wheel racing for a while as well, wasn't he?
Good friends with Pippo Pozzato. It probably won't surprise you to
never
discover.
Just back to your chat with Brian, though, Daniel. It was really interesting to hear how that progression from press officer to team manager to journalist went. And I just did want to pick him up on something about our constant grumbling, or my constant grumbling about the difficulty of getting dinner, or the press buffet. I mean, The thing about this is that we're working on the road. You know, we haven't got time to stop and have a nice lunch often. We are reliant on what is available in or near to the press room. And generally, if it's exceptionally good or exceptionally bad, then it gets a mention. But most of the time, it's just kind of middle of the road and fine, isn't it? It's there's more comedy value in the bad, which is probably why it gets more of a mention from me anyway.
This is why he proved only to be a temporary stand-in for you, Lionel.
Where's Brian tonight? Yeah. Oh, he's gone for dinner.
I can deal with our, with our lifestyle.
I can definitely see why Brian didn't last too long at Team Sky as the press officer, you know, based on his stories of abandoning the Giro to go and put five cases of Barolo away in his cellar midway through, you know, the third week of the race. Lovely story.
Brilliant. Well, listen, we we should wrap things up. What's coming up tomorrow,
well,
Daniel?
Rich, tomorrow we've got a very famous stage, or the start town and the finish town are very famous in the annals of cycling in the Giro. The Cuneo Pinerolo stage. The most famous Cuneo Pinerolo stage of all time was, well, probably the most famous Giro stage of all time, 1949, Fausto Coppi. Dominating and really putting the final nail in the coffin of Gino Bartali, certainly as far as that Giro was concerned. And of course, we were at
We weren't there. We didn't do that 49
Giro.
Science and Sport didn't sponsor us around the 1949 Giro.
We were on the Fausto Coppi trail last year, weren't we, Napalm?
We were, yes. Well, for a couple of days, weren't we? We went, and the year before, wasn't it? We went to the actual home village, Castellania.
Castellania, yeah.
And a beautiful little place in the hills there. Where were we? We were in Tortona, which was a hometown. That was for a stage finish. And we...
Novi Ligure. That was the stage finish.
That was where the Fausto Coppi Museum is, isn't it? But we were also outside the Villa Coppi, quite a grand building that perhaps needs a bit of a tidy up in the garden.
I remember...
Where are we, Lionel? We're outside the Villa Coppi in Novi Ligure.
We are outside the Villa Coppi, the former residence of one of the greats of Italian cycling. We're joined by another great of Italian cycling. Cue the national anthem, Lino di Mameli.
Ciao, dear listeners. I'm here and just immediately a quick thought about this stage. Don't you think that in cycling, I mean, Coppi has been a real myth for Italian cycling and for all the history of cycling, but don't you think that in cycling we speak too much about the past and not a lot about the present and future? This is a question.
Wow, Lionel, do you feel very out of place here? We've got Giro, we've got Gilberto Simoni just over there, and we've got, you know, Fausto Coppi's former gaff.
Well, the finish line was about a kilometre down there, actually, wasn't it? And the team buses have all parked in this long straight road. And it feels like there's a lot of history surrounding this house. Is it lived in now? I assume it is. It must be. It's still lived in?
His son lives there. Faustino still lives there. This is really where Fausto spent his dying days with the white lady, Giulia Occhini. And we're going to find out a bit more about her in the episode, aren't we?
We are, but let's just try and describe the house. I mean, it's rendered a sort of dusky salmon pink almost, isn't it? And it doesn't look like the most friendly of houses. I always think of houses as either being friendly or foreboding. And the gates aren't exactly welcoming, are they? It looks like they don't want people to be sort of turning up and saying hello.
It's not exactly an immaculately mowed lawn, is it? Faustino could do with investing in a Flymo.
He could, or maybe, yeah, hiring a landscape gardener. It does look like it's seen slightly better days, but the fact that Fausto Coppi lived there and the quite ornate, what would that... That's kind of almost bronze lettering on there saying Villa on one side and Coppi on the other. And lots of people have come to have their picture taken outside the Villa Coppi today, so it feels like it's quite a significant place for the Giro to almost finish the stage outside.
A flavour of Fausto Coppi there, and we're going to be looking and talking a lot more about Coppi and Bartali tomorrow. I've been looking forward to this episode, actually, of all of them, I think. I've been looking forward to all of them, but the Coppi Bartali story is a sort of... It hangs over the Giro and over Italian cycling, and even world cycling, I think. They're such significant figures. Their rivalry is such a great story. And they were competing in a golden era for cycling. So I'm looking forward to...
This is going to be our last
tomorrow.
Blast of real or sort of Giro-stalgia on our Giro, isn't it? Where we go way back in time, because our last two episodes are much closer to the present day.
Indeed. Before we go tonight, just want to read out a bit of an email that we had from Thomas William Powlett. I suspect you can't take requests, he writes, but I wonder if at the end of the podcast you could thank your friend and mine, Charlie Gilbank. He had a pretty bad crash on his bike last week. Punctured lung, broken ribs and collarbone. 3 nights in hospital. He is stuck at home in his Pedlar de Charme casket, not feeling very charming at the moment. Well, Charlie, hope our Giro is providing some distraction from your injuries and that you get well again soon and that you're back on your bike again soon. Sorry to hear about your accident. That's all from us for tonight. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard. Yeah.